Chapter 23, Auschwitz. On the next morning we arrived at Auschwitz. I knew a lot about that camp. When we passed the famous gate with the inscription Arbeit macht frei, work makes free, I had remembered an old childish illusion of mine which I had carried in my heart, but was ashamed to share with anyone. I had wished to be in Auschwitz, to suffer, but survive, so that I would be respected as a Jew after the war, unlike others who disappeared or even cooperated with the Nazis. What a stupid, childish idea. For me it was a sin, then, to be a Jew, and not one of the sufferers. In my naivety, I went so far as to consider any Jew who did not suffer as an enemy and a collaborator. From this point of view, and with Majdanek behind me, I pulled myself together with new hope. I wanted to live. I do not know whether it was my will to survive, or my fear of dying, that was behind this new strength. My suffering had reached such a huge dimension that it seemed that a normal grave would not have been sufficient for me. All the plagues that Pharaoh visited on people, I had experienced in my own body. Death could only be a relief. I regretted more and more that I had not understood that before. Was it worth giving up, ending my life after everything I had experienced? Was it not too late? Could there be anything worse ahead? I felt like someone who had missed the first and last trains, the train to death and the train to life. I had no alternative other than to push these thoughts aside, as in the Hebrew adage, what wisdom doesn't accomplish, time will. I left my fate to chance. We were gathered in a large, empty area where we were forced to undress and stand naked until evening. It was very cold. There were two big wooden tubs filled with hot and cold water. One after another, we were ordered to jump into both tubs. We received striped prisoners' clothes and canvas shoes with wooden soles, but we were not permitted to go further into the Auschwitz camp. We stood in a guarded area from which we could see the blocks and the prisoners. We were transferred by truck to the camp of Bunamonowitz, about 10 kilometers away. After the usual roll call with the endless numbers, a bath and delousing, we were examined for hidden objects. Again we impotently faced the men of the master race, in rows of five. Every prisoner was carefully observed and examined as if it were chattel at a slave market. Those who were accepted had a number tattooed on their left arm. My number was 128262. Some emaciated prisoners, the so-called Muselmänner, or Moslems, were chosen, taken away, and never seen again. Selection. At the naked parade in and after the bath, my marked backside attracted special attention. I was taken around by prisoners with special functions, exhibited to other prisoners, and pitied. I thought that it could not be as bad there as in the ghetto of Mijijek and in Majdanek. The 400 to 500 prisoners from the Majdanek transport were accommodated in one large tent. We were in quarantine and were separated from all the other prisoners. Our whole group was taken to the morning roll call and then to work, about 4 kilometers away. We had to labor in a deep, muddy canal, knee-deep in water, our wooden shoes always stuck in the mud. As soon as we pulled out one shoe, the other one stuck, and we slipped repeatedly. Under these conditions, we first had to fill the dump cars with clay and then pull them upwards. With the steep grade, there was always the danger that the heavy cars would roll backwards. Often there were injuries. The SS were stationed on dry land on each side of the canal and watched us. They continually called up prisoners, worked them over with wooden boards or rifle butts, and threw them back into the canal. The capos stood down below, cursed the prisoners, and beat them again. It was hell. In the evenings we had to carry the beaten, wounded, and half-dead prisoners on our backs so that they could be counted at roll call. For those injured prisoners, that roll call was almost always their last. Our strength declined rapidly. Many prisoners were pulled out of their rows and never seen again, since they were taken directly to the crematorium in Auschwitz. The rows of prisoners from Majdanek were noticeably thinned out. I also felt as if all my strength had gone. Extremely hard labor under the eyes of the guarding SS officials, insufficient food, no communication with fellow sufferers, all this and more that I cannot even describe, could not be endured by any human being for longer than 1 or 2 months. After about 6 weeks, the quarantine was over. Our camp and work detail were dissolved. According to our profession, we were divided into other details and transferred to different blocks. The Buna Monowitz camp, which we just called Buna, contained 10,000 prisoners who were leased as slave labourers to IG Farben works by the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the main security office of the Reich. The planned objective was that we should first work ourselves almost to death to the advantage of IG Farben, and then be liquidated. I was put in the Elektrokommando 128. Our capo was Erich Kohlhagen, a Jewish dentist from Halle. We were about 50 prisoners. After the daily roll call, which, as in all other concentration camps, lasted for hours in the rain and cold, we marched approximately 4 to 5 kilometers to work, to the accompaniment of music, which was played at the entrance gate. 5 to 10 prisoners at a time were assigned to a civilian master whose orders were to be followed absolutely. Our commando detail was under the command of Obermeister Kilian, a feared man who normally spoke only to the capo. For a certain period of time, my group was under the command of Master Hoppe from Leipzig. That changed, however. Hoppe's conversations with us were limited to allocation of work. He never inquired about our living conditions. He knew enough about them and did not need to ask. Occasionally he came once, twice, or even 3 times a day, stayed for about 10 or 20 minutes, then disappeared. He always showed up in a blue jacket, usually wearing high boots. In one he had a yardstick, in the other a spoon and fork, riveted together. Hence he could eat with either implement, but never with both. Was this the eating culture for the new European society as planned by the Nazis? One of these masters, who preferred to say 3 words too few rather than one too many, and who saw much more than he wanted to, I met in Leipzig after the war. He was working as a conductor on a streetcar. I greeted him and told him who I was, since I always considered him harmless. At the next stop he disappeared, and another driver took his place. All these masters had been ordered to be deaf and blind. The majority obeyed this order. They had ears that were unable to hear, eyes that could see nothing, and tongues that could not speak. Another master with whom I was able to exchange a few words came from Gleiwitz, and allegedly used his position to avoid being drafted. He had an assistant, a Ukrainian girl, who had been deported as a civilian. She, her name was Maria, was very open with me. Very often she offered me a part of her scanty bread ration, which I almost always refused. We talked about war and politics, and encouraged each other. Only once, shortly before Christmas 1944, when the winds of fate had changed and things looked different in the war, the master from Gleiwitz gave me a piece of cake. It was the first time in years that I had tasted cake. I regarded it as imperative to make special mention of one Master Kuss from Leipzig. He was small, slim, and well known for his friendliness towards us. Whenever the SS came near us, he always cried six. Six was our code word for approaching SS. Although I never accepted assistance from him, I knew that he had helped some of us. One day he disappeared, and we never saw him again. Rumours that he had been shot persisted. It was impossible to get more details, but it was well known that he was an anti-Nazi, and he had helped our people. All of us were sad to have lost him. He was one person whose continuing goodness could have restored our faith in mankind. I was fortunate to work in a hall, protected from the rain and the cold, which might have been one of the main reasons for my survival. Those of my fellow sufferers who were forced to work outside, laying cables, unloading cement, coal, iron, etc., hardly had a chance to survive. Under the given circumstances and the lack of nutrition, no one could last more than 3 or 4 months. In the winter it was even worse. Although it was strictly prohibited, we tied paper from cement sacks to our chests and backs for protection against the cold. People died by the score. Those who survived looked like mere shadows of their former selves. Some prisoners were so emaciated that their bones were visible, their feet resembled matchsticks. Others had bloated stomachs, swollen legs, and furuncles. A rampant disease amongst us was diarrhea. Smokers who exchanged their small food rations for tobacco, and enthusiastic dealers who bargained with their basic rations, contributed to their own destruction, and thereby delivered themselves up involuntarily to the Nazis. It was impossible to live on the normal food rations, and trading was even worse. It was self-torture for those who tried to divide their rations into small pieces and eat them at intervals. During the day they carried their tiny morsels with them, and at night they hid them under their heads to keep them for later. They never allowed themselves to be distracted and were unable to sleep at night. This self-imposed contest between stomach and soul became an additional nail in their own coffins. A missing pair of glasses, a lack of medicine, too much rumination, some apathy, traces of weakness and defeatism, losing control over oneself just once, branded a person as a Musulman, and that was the beginning of the end. Our executioners soon attacked us like beasts. Our chances of surviving were about the same as those of an inexperienced tightrope walker trying to cross an ocean on a rope. But thinking back to Majdanek and the quarantine period, I could almost be content, despite everything. In order not to attract attention, I always restrained myself and kept my distance from the capo. He was very strict, but he tried to be fair. Nothing that happened around him was of any importance to him, or at least he pretended that it was so. He was not able to help anyway. Regarding his work detail, he was like an adamant father who establishes a certain order. His attention was concentrated on making sure that all his prisoners were clean, well-dressed, well-accommodated in the block, and that we completed our work to the satisfaction of the master. His main insistence, however, was warning us not to be conspicuous in a negative way. He was feared, but at the same time appreciated and respected by us. I remember that he did everything humanly possible to spare his work detail during the selections. When he addressed me on my first days at work, my voice quivered. I do not know whether it was out of fear or respect, and I made the mistake of addressing him as Herr Capo, Mr. Capo. With the words, "What kind of a hare am I for you?" he slapped my face twice, so hard that I almost fell down. I understood immediately that these two slaps were the first justified blows I received in a concentration camp. My camp education had failed and had shown its deficiencies. Those two slaps, which I both understood and forgave, were truly warranted. There is an unwritten law in prisons and concentration camps which says that in these places there are no Herren. I simply was not aware of the etiquette of Auschwitz and had violated that law. Herschel Bergesin, a very fine man who also looked compulsively clean, was one of the leading workers and the capo's first helper. He survived and lives today in Montevideo. Thousands of civilians, foreign workers of all nationalities, even British prisoners of war and Russian Vlasov soldiers worked at the Buno camp. Our food rations were really starvation ones. In the morning a piece of bread with a little margarine and a bowl of soup at night. Our IG Farben employer was so generous that he also contributed a small amount of soup for lunch, the so-called Buna soup. It was grey in colour and contained no potatoes or any other edible additions, not to mention vegetables, fat or meat. Allegedly it was made from spinach, probably because of its colour. The technicians, engineers or directors who often came to the plant neither wanted to eat or taste the soup. That was unfortunate, because it was almost pure poison from IG Farben. Through our work, contact with the civilians around us was unavoidable. Again, I began risking everything in order to avoid dying from starvation, as I had promised myself. I smuggled shirts, blankets and sweaters out of the camp and traded them for bread and margarine. As soon as I was satisfied and still had a reserve for the next day, I stopped smuggling. I kept this promise and made it the guiding principle of my life in the camps. Organizing food was, of course, very dangerous and severely punished. If one was caught, it meant a brutal beating or transfer to a penal detail or a detention camp. One always gambled with one's own life. Unlike Majdanek, I was fortunate enough never to be caught in Buna. My contacts sometimes brought me only bread or margarine. Thus it also happened that I would eat an entire pound package of margarine only. Through our contacts, we often received details of the war situation. The news filled us with courage and new hope. We were even able to obtain newspapers like the Völkische Beobachter and the Oberschlesische Zeitung through civilians, and we smuggled them into the camp. We felt greater satisfaction when the plant was bombed several times. We prisoners did not hide, but we enjoyed seeing the SS disappear so that nothing was to be seen of them. It would have been easy to escape during those air raids, but where to? There were no Jews left with whom one could hide. Our world had been destroyed long before. For us, the bombings marked the beginning of the end of our suffering, about which, despite everything, we never stopped dreaming. It is perhaps difficult to understand why we prisoners were happy about the bombings, since we could also have been victims. The bombs, however, hit all people, regardless of race, belief, or nationality. Bombs have no designation address. They hit everyone. All other tortures, beatings, deportations, gas chambers, and executions were used exclusively against Jews. All people with my past have learned about and are prepared to bear the sufferings attendant upon life, provided they are also given the opportunity to enjoy its pleasures. To suffer with all people, regardless of station or race, did not hurt that much. One day in 1944, a barrack was built and fenced in with barbed wire in the middle of the camp at Bunar, close to the formation field. About 20 women, supposedly of all nationalities, were brought in and a brothel was set up. Prominent prisoners, elders of blocks, and capos from different countries were allowed to visit them with coupons obtained from the camp administration. But mixing of races was prohibited. All races were represented among the women except Jews. Jews were not allowed to satisfy their sexual desires. These feelings among them were supposed to be suppressed by the bromine that was added to their soup. But it helped us to joke and be of good cheer. Long live the Jewish humor. It is healthy to laugh. Our first job in the Bunar plant was to install the provisional electric lighting in the new power plant, in building 702 to 703. As we entered the cellars, we were in total darkness. Floors had not yet been installed. Small and large concrete blocks and many holes were obstacles for us. Before the first light was installed, several prisoners had suffered broken bones. We never saw those people again. Together with several other prisoners, I was later given the task of setting electric motors on concrete bases. It was labor which could not be evaluated by time or performance. We sabotaged the work as much as we could, talked during working hours, made plans, and even dreamed of the future. The main subject in regard to the past, the present, and the future always remained food. Everyone told us each other how well and how much he used to eat. According to what was said, hardly anyone had ever eaten dark bread or any expensive food like potatoes. The greatest wish for the future was to eat a whole loaf of white bread, preferably with butter, whenever we wanted. We would salivate as we spoke. This is how hungry people talk. Our plans for the future mainly concerned Israel. We wanted to have a country of our own, never again to depend on mercy of others. We envied all those who were already in Israel. It was truly a dream which hardly anyone believed could come true, although no one doubted the end of the Nazis. Some dreamed of travelling throughout the world as survivors and reporting on the almost unimaginable events and massacres in the ghettos and concentration camps. The following generations had to be told of the greatest genocide of all time. The conversation almost always ended in a mood of depression, especially when we talked about murdered family members, our horrible present life, and what we would have to face if we survived. The biggest optimist in our group proved to be a Pole who always repeated, "Fellow sufferers, don't worry. Whoever has talent in his fingers will never fail in life." He was supposedly a professional pickpocket. Even in the hours of desperation with death awaiting them, some Jews in the towns and ghettos put on their talises and with a prayer book in their hand, the Shema Israel, Hear, O Israel, on their lips, they went to meet their end. Others were so upset by their own suffering and family tragedies that they rebelled against God, and because of their experiences they lost their faith. In my work in Commando No. 128, there were some Jews, mostly from Hungary and Greece, who figured out the date of Yom Kippur, commemorated and fasted. They did the same on Tisha B'Av, marking the day the temple was destroyed. They even wanted to observe Passover by not eating bread. On all those days, one could read the words of prayers on their lips. Kapo Kohlhagen showed respectful understanding in that regard. Those people demonstrated an uncompromising dedication to the faith and an iron will by imposing additional fasting on themselves. Holding the bread ration of Auschwitz in one's hand and not eating it exhibited extraordinary heroism. In one group from my detail, I worked with a French Jew, Spiro. He claimed that he had lived in Paris and had led the communist youth movement there. He was known amongst us as a pleasant and educated man with whom one could discuss any topic for hours. He criticized me and all the others who smuggled shirts, sweaters, etc. out of the camp to exchange them for bread. His criticism was most acute when someone was caught smuggling and was punished accordingly. Unfortunately, that happened quite often, and the punishments were severe. Spiro believed that smuggling was immoral, since every stolen piece of clothing meant a prisoner for whom that piece was lacking. He was actually the only one who held that opinion, which was based on a general ethic of concentration camp justice. It was easy for him to castigate, since he found considerable support for his belief among his friends, the French doctors at the medical building. Almost every evening after roll call, he went to his friends in the medical building and then reported to us the next morning everything he had heard about the political situation and whatever else he had learned. He said that he belonged to a French resistance group that had been formed in the medical building. He comforted us with good news and predictions of the war's end. I do not know whether he survived. Although a great deal has been written about Auschwitz and the adjoining camps, the morning and evening roll calls must be described again and again. During the long, cold, and always dark hours of the roll call, we leaned back to back on each other to help us bear the bitter cold a little bit better. Or we stood very close in front of the other, spreading warmth with our breath. Even that was prohibited. It also happened that sometimes a prisoner would escape. We then were forced to stand in formation until he was caught, and until the alert for the whole area was called off. It was not unusual to stand for 3, 6, or even 8 hours. The same ritual took place when prisoners were hanged. Hangings in Buna were always carried out during the roll call. Everyone had to watch. I shall never forget the time when 3 young Jews from Berlin and Krakow, Diamant, Grossfield, and Fleischmann, were about to be hanged. The first cried out, "Comrades, heads up! We are the last ones." The German Kuchera, the elder of the camp, a professional criminal with a green patch on his chest, enjoyed putting the rope round a sentenced man's neck after an SS official read the judgment. "In the name of the Reichsleader of the SS, prisoner number is sentenced to death by hanging." For an unknown reason, one day Kuchera wanted to give some prisoners the honor of placing the rope round the 3 condemned men's necks. But none wanted to perform the dirty deed. We stood in rows of 5 in the roll call area. As soon as Kuchera approached the front rows, all in the other lines stepped back. The same happened when he tried it in another place. Each step towards the crowd made the entire group step back. This happened spontaneously. It was a kind of passive resistance. Kuchera found himself in an embarrassing predicament and was finally compelled to go to the scaffold himself. Under the eyes of the prisoners and the 3 sentenced men, he put the ropes around their necks. Unforgettable is the old inmate Chaim Wideslewski, the block chief. He was a decent character, always ready to help, acting as a go-between between the camp elders. One day there was an alert. Chaim, along with 2 Jewish and 2 Polish inmates from the upper stratum of the camp, had escaped. After an appel assembly, which lasted for many hours, we were finally dismissed. A few days later we saw the 2 Poles. It was rumored that they had been recaptured in Krakow quite drunk. Only later did we learn the worst. The 2 Poles had murdered the 2 Jews, their fellow inmates, in the forest, most probably to rob them. The 2 Poles were hanged in the camp. At another time, a 16-year-old boy from Hungary who had not been at camp for too long was missing at the roll call. We had to stand in the rain and cold for hours. Finally, it was discovered that the little boy was a pupil of his capo, who wore a green patch of a criminal. He had raped, killed, and buried the boy in the sand. The SS dogs found him. The capo was stoned publicly and beaten to death. This too was SS justice. With the war dragging on, the situation in the camp worsened. Selections increased, especially in the mornings and evenings, while marching out or in. Also, the blocks were searched for weak, emaciated prisoners, the so-called Muselmen. They immediately were ordered to undress, and their clothes were taken from them. In the rain and cold, they were driven naked onto the waiting trucks and transferred to the crematoria in the main camp at Auschwitz. The victims and everyone in the camp knew exactly where this journey would end. Heartbreaking scenes took place. Fathers, brothers, relatives and friends saw each other for the last time. Every European nation was represented at Auschwitz. Some prisoners received food parcels occasionally. These non-Jews were fortunate. Their chances for survival were much better than ours. Only we Jews got nothing but beatings. We never heard of the Red Cross, let alone received anything from them. Many new transports arrived, especially from Hungary. Some of the prisoners who were there for a long time ran in desperation against the electrified fence of the camp and perished there. If they were noticed by the guards, they were shot and left hanging on the fence. Generally, there were only hours, perhaps minutes, for one to pull oneself out of despondency. The long days and nights, weeks and months, passed in complete apathy, desperation, pain, and preoccupation with the hopelessness of our situation. It was a growing vegetation without end. In such a state of mind, there were times when the final penalty, death, became insignificant and no longer mattered. On the other hand, the petty chicaneries became more painful and upset us to a greater extent. One of these cruel pranks was the order to sew up all the pockets in our clothes, including the pants, since it was forbidden to have these. Our only possessions were undershirt, underpants, the jacket and the trousers we wore, a striped cap, a suit plate, and a spoon. Famished, emaciated, and freezing, our two pants pockets were the only place we could use to warm our hands when we were not working, standing at attention, or removing our caps in front of SS officials. One day I noticed several boils on my neck. When they got larger and looked more dangerous, I went to the medical building. The prison doctor told me that the boils were a consequence of poor and insufficient food, and also of typhus. He could not give me any medication or better rations. Thus, I would probably be selected for the gas chamber unless the boils were operated on, i.e. cut open. I agreed, even though anesthesia was not available, and the bandages used were made of paper. I lay down on my stomach on a cot. My hands and feet were tied to the side bars, and my head was held tightly. Without any anesthesia and suffering unbearable pain, the boils were lanced. For weeks and months thereafter, I was afraid that my paper bandages would be discovered. It would have been sufficient reason for selection, and that area of the neck was watched most when we marched past the camp gate. I lowered my head and pressed the bandages down while pulling my collar up. I was fortunate and managed to get through. When I received my first identification card after the war, those scars were registered as distinguishing marks. I just laughed. Today I still bear the marks on my neck. In Block 11, where my work commander was accommodated, the camp's band was also housed. The musicians, 30 to 50 people from all countries, always played when the prisoners marched in or out. There I got to know a Pole, Busson, from Bromberg, with whom I soon became friendly, but not without a definite reason. The band members were considered half-prominent and were spared from working in the plant. They always remained in the camp. My friend Busson provided me with underwear, sweaters, and scarves, in exchange for which I usually gave him tobacco. The elder of the block, a Jew named Gluckstein, had converted to Christianity before the war, but the Nuremberg laws made him Jewish again. He was a clever man of small stature and strikingly meticulous, who knew how to climb upward. In the camp he was called Pippel. He obviously sympathized with the camp prominence, the big providers, corrupt SS officials, capos, elders of the block, and other functionaries, all of whom managed to eat, drink, and live well in the camp. One Sunday, Kuchera, the block elder of the camp, surprised us with a visit to our block. The green patch on his jacket showed that he was German and a professional criminal. Pippel jumped up and shouted, according to the regulations, "Attention, caps off!" Kuchera walked slowly together with Pippel between the plank beds and inspected everything very carefully. For some unknown reason, Pippel directed Kuchera's attention to me. The elder of the camp looked at me and discovered that I was wearing a sweater which was prohibited. This fat, brutal giant, with hands like bear's paws, used to execute his own brand of justice on the spot. He slapped me in his special way. He always slapped the right side of the face so hard that the victim fell to the left. In the next moment he slapped the left side of the face so that the beaten man fell backwards. His victims were not allowed to fall down. They had to endure his blows while standing, so that he could see and enjoy the fear in their eyes. Like a soccer player who kicks with the right foot as well as the left, Kuchera could hit with his right hand as well as his left. He did so from both sides in a fraction of a second. After several slaps he allowed himself a break of satisfaction, laughed, and emitted sounds that reminded one of a wild and angry animal. I do not know how many slaps I got. When I was sitting on my bed recovering, Pippel came to me and excused himself for having directed Kuchera's attention to me. He regretted that I had to be the victim this time. I had been in the camp long enough to know that the camp elder never walked into a block without having some score to settle. Pippel was right. Someone had to be chosen. It was my misfortune to be standing in the wrong place. Even among professional criminals, people who were as brutal as Kuchera were not to be found in unlimited supply. I cannot imagine that he ever thought of a possible end to Auschwitz. I do not know what happened to him, whether he disappeared together with the SS or in another criminal underworld. Pippel's gesture of excusing himself impressed me. I simply was not used to having someone apologize for beatings. Apparently it was his clever way of not making unnecessary enemies. However, I never knew how I should classify him as a human being. He certainly did not belong to the 36 righteous men of the Bible, or at the courts of the Rabbi of Gur. Pippel allegedly survived the war and crawled away to some place where nobody knew him. I think he knows why. Whether he was an opportunist or a swindler, he had style and belonged to the elite. Like Pippel, the elder of the room, Kogut, was also from Lodz. His world revolved basically around his hometown, and he divided his fellow sufferers into two categories, those from Lodz and the others. He was a decent, simple Jew who loved order and tried to preserve his good reputation. If he helped one, he could only have come from Lodz. Lodz was always with him. If he ever lowered the ladle deeper into the soup pot, it was only because the recipient was from Lodz. In those times when people changed so quickly due to selections and deportations, any friendships created usually lasted a short time. There were some, however, which endured longer. At that time I befriended Jacob Hendeles, who later became my brother-in-law. With the arrival of each new transport, we hoped that we might meet a relative or a friend, since that was the only way we could hear some news about the world outside the camp. But we rarely learned anything, since most of the new arrivals came from other concentration camps. We longed to see friends again, and were disappointed when we did not, but we were never sure whether it was a reason for joy or concern. Where could our friends be? Were they rescued? Did they escape or die? Were they deported, beaten to death? Or were they half-existing, half-dead, and starving in some concentration camp? A newcomer was lucky, if he was assigned to a good Arbeitskommando, which could be decisive for his future. It also happened that a new prisoner was recognized as having had an infamous past, and as having served our persecutors by tormenting us. For such prisoners the bell had already tolled, the score would be settled with them. I also looked for compatriots and silently hoped to meet a member of my chevar. Unfortunately, I waited in vain. Then one day I met some friends from Rajin, Abram Schumacher, Getzel, and Josiah Rosenkrantz. Since at that time I was a relatively experienced prisoner and fairly familiar with everything, I tried to support my newly arrived friends in word and deed, and to help them with a piece of bread and soup now and then. One day before roll call, these friends introduced me to Isaac Kupiec. He was an active Zionist who had left Radzin in the early 30s and emigrated to kibbutz in Palestine. For special reasons and under unusual circumstances, he had left Israel and had participated in the Spanish Civil War. In the meantime, he had become an enthusiastic communist. Together with Spanish veterans, he found asylum in France and lived in Paris, where he was arrested by the Gestapo and sent to Auschwitz. He remembered my older sister Edessa. We knew each other's families. Even earlier, he had been known to us as a sensation. That morning, he told me that he had come from the camp of Jaworznov, a subsidiary of Auschwitz, where the prisoners worked in coal mines. I never saw him in Buna again, since he reported he was transferred to another camp. After the war, I heard that he had survived, and this made me very happy. The year 1944 was close to ending when the situation in the war took an unfavorable turn for the Nazis. We felt that the worst was behind us, and this strengthened our resolve to persevere and survive.